Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Dvaita Gadadhara Srivastani Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai. Sri Sri Radha Krishna Gaura Gopinath Anukunda Radha Kunda Giddi Govardhana Ki Jai. Vrindavan Dhamma Ki Jai. Mathura Dhamma Ki Jai. Navadvipa Maya Pura Dhamma Ki Jai. Jagannath Puri Dhamma Ki Jai. Gangamaya Jamuna Devi Ki Jai. Bhakti Devi Ki Jai. Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai. Samvita Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai. Gaura Prema. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Sri Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Vishnu Prasthaya Vipanishu Mata Bhakti Vedanta Swami Namani Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pachamani Vasesa Sanyana Paskachadi Satarani Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Vichapatam Sri Guru Vaishnavastra Sri Rupam Sahagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vidam Sam Sajivam Sakhwetam Sahagrajatam Gadijana Saita Krishna Chaitanya Deva Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Raghunatham Sri Shakam Vidam Sri Vanchakabu Chupastam Kipasam Deva Jati Chani Vamani Vashu Vidam Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. March 10th, 2015, in Auckland, New Zealand, and we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 6, Conversation between Narada and Vyasadeva, Text 1. Suta Uvacha, Evam Nisamnyam Bhagavan, Devarsher Janmakarmacha, Bhuya Paprachatam Brahman, Yasa Satya Vati Sutta. Please chant. Sutta Uvacha. Sutta Goswami said, Evam, thus, Nisamya, hearing, Bhagavan, the powerful incarnation of God, Devarshahe, of the great sage among the gods, Janma, birth, Karma, work, Kha, and Bhuyaha, again, Prapacha, asked him, Brahman, O Brahmanas, Vyasaha, Vyasadeva, Satyavati Sutta, the son of Satyavati. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Sutta said, O Brahmanas, thus hearing all about Sri Narada's birth and activities, Vyasadeva, the incarnation of God and son of Satyavati, inquired as follows. Purport. Vyasadeva was further inquisitive to know about the perfection of Naradajan, and therefore he wanted to know about him more and more. In this chapter, Naradajan will describe how he was able to have a brief audience with the Lord while he was absorbed in the transcendental thought of separation from the Lord, and when it was very painful for him. Sutta uvacha evam nisamyam bhagavan devarshir janma karmacha bhuya prapachitam brahman vyasa satyavati sutta. Sutta said, O Brahmanas, thus hearing all about Sri Narada's birth and activities, Vyasadeva, the incarnation of God and son of Satyavati, inquired as follows. So Prabhupada mentions here in the purport that Narada had a brief audience with the Lord. This is very fascinating. How do we get to see the Lord, even if just briefly? Right? Everybody like to see the Lord even briefly? Yes. Okay. Sometimes it's like, can't you just show yourself to me for a minute? And then it's like, well, if I did, then you wouldn't want me to leave. You know, you wouldn't be satisfied with a minute. And that's exactly what happens. Right? Narada Muni sees the Lord for a moment, and then he's like, I want to see him more, I want to see him more. It's not like a something material where you just, you know, you see it once and then been there, seen that, done that. Okay, I saw the Lord. Right, next. Right? Just like I saw an advertisement on an airplane, you know, they have the screens that come down and they're showing you the safety procedures, and then they may also show you some advertisements. So they were advertising the airlines itself. Fly with our airlines all around the world, and they're showing this country and that country and this country and that country, most of which I've been to. And I looked at it and I thought, that's not very interesting. Now, if you were going to fly to other planets, that might be interesting. You know, this kind of been there, seen that, done that. But you never feel that way with the Lord. It's interesting with the Lord. One feels complete satisfaction, but no satiation. Right? Materially, it's just the opposite. Materially, you get satiated, but not satisfied. Materially, like enough. You take your favorite food, whatever it is, pizza. You know, if you have pizza for breakfast, and then for lunch, and then for dinner, and then for lunch, dinner. Enough. But, you know, you never feel completely satisfied. You can't say with the best pizza, the best lasagna, the best laddus, or whatever each of us likes, oh, now I'm completely, on all levels, I'm satisfied. It's not like that. One doesn't feel this ananda muri more than an expanding ocean of happiness. But with the Lord, one feels expanding, unlimited happiness, but you never feel like you have enough. You can always have more and more and more and more. So this idea of being complete and yet expanding. Mars was talking about this in his last class. Be complete and yet expanding. Whereas material enjoyment is always incomplete and it decreases. It's never complete in the first place. You never say, now I have complete happiness, materially boundless, unlimited material happiness. And then your enjoyment of it decreases. Right? He gave the example that people who win the lottery after 6 months or a year, their life becomes just normal. It even happens with painful things. You know, someone becomes a quadriplegic, and after a year, they're just as happy as they were before the accident or the disease. And we become used to it. So why not want to see the Lord? Of all the things we could want to see, of all the things we could want to do, we really want to see the Lord, isn't it? Right? That's what we want to see. We want to see the Lord. Of course, I'm just thinking when the devotees came to Jagannath Puri, they didn't go to see Lord Jagannath immediately. They went to see Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And this really bewildered King Pratyaprabhuja, who was watching from the rooftop. He said, they're not shaving their heads, they're not fasting, they're not going to see the deity, they're immediately going to see Lord Chaitanya. Why is that? And even Lord Chaitanya, he said to Ramananda Roy, what are you doing? Why did you come to see me before seeing Lord Jagannath? And Ramananda Roy said, well, the body has to follow the heart. So the devotees, they just want to see the Lord directly. Right? They're not even interested in seeing this fancy building or this, you know, mountain. They just just wanted to see the Lord. So how do we see the Lord? What induces the Lord to come? Because you can't see the Lord by banging on his door, you know, or by sneaking like these, what do they call them, the paparazzi, who try to find some celebrity, right? And they try to find some way, they use some sort of special camera, they can zoom from a distance, and they stay up all night at the place where they think the person will come, and of course the celebrity often has a back door, or they come out with some disguise, and you know, they miss them. But you can't do this with Krishna. I mean, it's hard enough to do this with some small movie star on some little planet in one universe. Right? If you want to see somebody who's famous for 5 years on the Earth planet, it's a little difficult. Or to speak of, if you want to see God, how are you going to do it? You know, you could try hanging out in Vrindavan on the Parikrama path or something, or by Keshigat, with your special camera, figure the Lord's going to come by and to take care of his cows, and maybe you'll get a picture. But it's not going to work like that. He has to reveal himself to you. Of course, we're going to find that. I don't want to spoil the rest of the chapter, but we're going to find like this that Narada Muni has his process. But the Lord comes when he's going to come. So if we want to find out how to see the Lord, the best way, Mahajananyena, Yathasvamanta, we follow the path of the Mahajana. And Narada Muni, of course, Swayambhu, Narada, Sambhu, Akomara, Kapilo, Manu, Prahlada, Janaka, Bhishma, Balir, Vyasaki, or Vayam. Those are the 12 Mahajanas, and one of them is Narada. So here we find that Vyasadeva and the sages at Namasharana, they're very eager to hear about Narada. How did he see the Lord? If I can find out how Narada saw the Lord, then, you know, I can follow in his footsteps, and I can see the Lord too. Because that verse, Mahajanayena, Gatasvapanta, it starts out by saying, you know, you're not going to figure it out just by reading the scriptures. You're not going to figure it out just by reading the scriptures, because you read the scriptures and you're going to have different opinions at different times. Right? I'm just reading this in Teachings of Lord Chaitanya this morning, how there's different processes for different ages. And, you know, the process for one age isn't going to work for another age, or for one person isn't going to work for another person. And you can read the scriptures and you'll get confused. You'll adopt the wrong process. It's something like if you just try to get your medical advice from the internet, right? You'll find something that won't apply to you. You won't diagnose yourself properly. You won't get the proper kind of medicine. And if you try to use logic, I'm going to find the Lord this way and that way, your logic may betray you. Logic isn't perfect, as any of us who've played with logic have discovered. You know, one person can defeat another, and Lord Chaitanya used to love to play with logic like this when he was a young boy. So he would make an argument, and then he would defeat his own argument, and then he would defeat his defeat of his argument, and then he would defeat his defeat of his argument, and he would defeat his defeat of his defeat of his defeat. And you can do that if you're trained. I used to be in the debating club, and you were trained how to do that. You were trained how to come up with an argument and defeat and defeat and defeat and defeat, so that nobody could ever establish truth just simply by logic. This is what happens in modern science. One scientist comes up with some theory, and another scientist defeats it, another scientist defeats it. So therefore, the only way you have to follow the Mahajanas. So then we should be eager to hear about the Mahajanas. And I was really thinking about this janma karma cha, because Krishna says, janma karma cha me divyam evam yoveti tatvita takta deham punarjanma naitamami swarjana. If you want to attain to the transcendental kingdom, Prabhupada quotes this verse a lot, all you have to do is know about Krishna's janma and karma. You have to know how Krishna's janma and karma are divyam. They're transcendental. And if you understand that, then you enter into the kingdom of God. We are not interested only in Krishna's janma and karma. We're also interested in Devarshiva's janma and karma. We're interested in the devotee's janma and karma, because the devotees show us how to find God. This is one of the main components of rasa. So many times when we think of rasa, we only think of the Steinbach component. The Steinbach component is whether Krishna is your master, Krishna is your friend, Krishna is your child, Krishna is your lover. That's the Steinbach, the what Prabhupada calls continuous ecstasy, the basic relationship. like each of us with each other, we have some certain foundational relationship. Sometimes with us, of course, it changes over our lifetime. Sometimes your friend becomes your enemy, or your employer becomes your husband, or, you know, we have things that can shift. But with Krishna, it's fixed, that we have a particular relationship. But that's not enough for rasa. It's not enough for rasa. You also have to have the other four components, so it's explained only when these five things mix together do you really have rasa. So one of them is vibhav, and vibhav is what stimulates that feeling, that continuous ecstasy, that sthayibha. And vibhav has two main categories, alambana and udipana. So alambana is like the cause. Prabhupada described it as the cause, and the udipans are like the context. So the cause is Krishna as the vishaya, the enjoyer, like we're told to give up being vishayas, yes? Vishaya chari vase vase majiya mukhe. Don't try to become the vishaya. Krishna is the vishaya. And then the devotees are the ashraya. The devotees are the shelter of this relationship. And materially we can understand this very easily. Just like if you see a child alone, you may feel some stirrings of parental rasa. If I just see a child playing, then I may feel some, there may be some emotion of care, correct? Or we may feel, oh, so cute. If you see a parent taking care of the child, that may increase. One time waiting for an airplane, there was a little girl all dressed up like some little princess or something. Why they had her in a costume to go on the plane. But anyway, she was all dressed up. She was very little, 2 or 3 years old. And the mother and father were there, and there was a lot of affection between the parents and this child. And the affection of the parents for the child increased everyone else's feelings for the child. So everybody waiting for this plane practically was just smiling and feeling affection for this child, not just from the child, but from the parents' dealings with the child. Or when Ajamil became attracted to the Sudrani, it was not just that he saw her interacting with a man, correct? And it was the man's interaction with her also. It wasn't just her, but seeing some man interacting with her romantically brought out his romantic feelings. So this is Krishna is the Vishaya and the devotee is the Ashraya. And therefore, we meditate not only on Krishna, but we meditate on Krishna with the devotees. As Srila Prabhupada explains in the Bhagavatam, I think it's 10.9.3, it's 10-something-3, I don't know if it's 10.3, I think it's 10.9.3, but some 3 is in there. So Mother Yasoda is churning the butter. She's churning the yogurt to make butter, and as she's churning, the flowers are falling out of her hair, and she's perspiring, which is interesting that she's perspiring, by the way, because, you know, the demigods don't perspire. Demigods don't perspire, their clothes don't get dirty, they don't have to have washing machines. No deodorant, no washing machines. They don't blink their eyes. They don't need to have, you know, eye drops, things like that. But in Goloka, the residents are doing these things. The gopis complain about their eyes blinking. And even Krishna's perspiring, and Krishna's dirty. Krishna comes home from the pasturing grounds, and he's covered with dust, and he's covered with perspiration. Interesting, isn't it? These are the Nara Lila Vasta, the human-like, very sweet pastimes. How interesting that Krishna in his highest abode is the perfection of human-like pastimes instead of the perfection of demigod-like pastimes. If you want to go to the perfection of demigod-like pastimes, that's Vaikuntha, where you have the ultimate reality of which the heavenly planets are a reflection. But how fascinating that when you go to the highest realm, you find the reality of which this earth is a reflection, even though the earth is a lower planet. The upside-down banyan tree, that what appears to be what's very low here, it actually is very low here, is very high there. Anyway, Srila Prabhupada says in that purport, that one who is attracted to the Lord in Vatsalya Rasa should meditate on Mother Yasoda and her mood for Krishna. Of course, if you're attracted in Vatsalya Rasa as a father, then you would meditate on Nanda Maharaj with Krishna. So this is the process of bhakti, that one meditates on the devotee with Krishna, not just Krishna, And this is certainly true at the higher realms, as we've just been describing, when one starts entering into rasa, then one is meditating on Krishna with the devotee, like you find the prayer of Narottama Das Thakur, Sri Rupa Majari Pada, that he's praying not just to Krishna. Have you read that prayer? Everybody's read that song? Sri Rupa Manjari Pada, if you haven't looked at it for a while, go take a look at it. The outpouring of love for Rupa Manjari is just astonishing. It's the kind of thing one would say to Krishna, you know, if I don't see you, it's like a snake has bitten me, and so forth and so on. But no matter what stage of devotion one is, even if one's just a beginning neophyte, one still understands Krishna through the devotees. Not just Krishna as the Vishaya, Krishna as the enjoyer, but the devotee as the ashraya, the devotee as the repository of love for Krishna. So if we want to see, so many ways we can understand it. Right? We want to understand this Devarsya Janma Karma Cha, because we can only understand the truth through the Mahajanas. We can't understand the truth through the Shastras and through logic. We want to understand the devotee because this is the higher realm of sweetness. And for the beginner, one who needs to understand to the devotee, because otherwise we don't have a model. If somebody just says, you know, Trinana Peace and Chena Devotee Vasu, okay. But what does that mean? You have to have some kind of a model. We're going to do, Krishna willing, a visioning exercise at the school this week. And the kind of visioning exercise that we always do is that we imagine the perfect student. If you had a student who came from the school from when they were 5 to when they're how long does the school go up to? 14, 15? 13. So if you had a student that started at 5 and went till they were 13, what would they look like? I don't mean physiologically, but you know, what would they be? What would they know? What would they be able to do? What kind of character would they have? And you make it a real person, at least in your imagination. You know, what person could I meet? I'm meeting this person at age 14, and they say, I went to the Hare Krishna school from when I was 5. What would that person be like if they were the ideal student? Or if a person only came for a year, what would they look like? And we can think like this in terms of our temple also. You know, if some guest comes to the temple for one day, what knowledge will they gain? What skills will they have learned? How will it have impacted their character? If somebody's a member of the congregation, they're coming to the Sunday feast and the festivals every week, every festival for 1 year, what changes will we see in their knowledge and their skills and in their character? And we could also say that, you know, someone living on this property, a member of the community, and by looking at that kind of question, by making it into a person, then you can think, oh, this is what we want to do. Does that make sense to everybody? If you say, you know, at the end of 8 years in the school, the children should know 50 Bhagavad Gita verses, for example, just as an example, then you structure your classes so you're teaching those 50 Bhagavad Gita verses. If you say that anybody who visits the temple, even for one day, should come away with some knowledge about Srila Prabhupada, as an example, I'm just giving this as an example, then we would have some sort of information about Srila Prabhupada that we gave to all of the visitors. Whatever we decide, this is what it looks like, then you know your path. You can't really figure out your path until you know what the goal looks like. Unless you have your prayojana, unless you have your goal, you can't figure out your abhidhamma. Does this make sense to everybody? So the goal in Krishna consciousness is a person. When we say, what do we want to achieve in Krishna consciousness, we want to achieve something for me as a person. Is the sound okay, or is it still messed up?
No, I have to go. I'm going to sit with Krishna.
Oh, okay.
It's still a little late.
Still a little fuzzy?
Yeah.
Okay.
Keep working.
Okay. Please offer Maharaj my obeisances. So how are we going to have this person that represents our goal, that represents our vision, that represents what we want to achieve? So therefore we have to study the devotees, Janma and Karma. So therefore all of these reasons, we want to study what did the devotees do. Because we see, oh, this is how Narada saw the Lord. Oh, okay, that's what I can do. This is how Dhruva Maharaja saw the Lord. Oh, that's what I can do. This is what Srila Prabhupada did. This is what Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati did. This is what Kunti did. This is, you know, we look at their lives, and you can't do a copy-paste. You know, you can't just say, okay, I'm going to go at 5 years old to the forest. And, you know. Or like Dhruva Maharaj, I'm going to breathe once every month. I mean, I couldn't do that. But you can still get some idea then, all right, what is my process? How to attract the Lord. So here, of course, in the verse itself, we don't really get much of an idea, because this verse is simply saying that the question was asked by Vyasadeva about Narada's jnana and karma. And the sages are asking. So we have two levels here, or perhaps three levels of asking. But in the purport, Srila Prabhupada gives us a little foreshadowing. He's giving us a little glimpse into the future of the story, which Prabhupada often does that. Like when you read in the fifth canto, The Forest of Material Enjoyment, it's really interesting because Judd Barrett is giving this analogy to Maharaj Yogananda. And when Judd Barrett gives the analogy, he doesn't explain it as he gives it. He gives the analogy, and then Maharaj Yogananda says, I don't understand this at all. Could you explain it? Then there's a whole other chapter where Judd Barrett explains it. But Srila Prabhupada explains the analogy the first time it's given in his purports, and sometimes even interwoven into the verses. So you end up with two explanations. You end up with the analogy, with the explanation when it's given the first time, and then a further explanation when it's given the second time. So here we have a little foreshadowing of what is there about Narada's life that's so special. I mean, there's so many aspects about Narada's life. But particularly this one, Srila Prabhupada has picked in the purport as the most significant. And what is this? He had a brief audience with the Lord. And how did he do this? So we get, he was absorbed, transcendental thought, separation from the Lord, very painful. So the very painful part perhaps doesn't sound so attractive. But we have, this is our little clue here. This is kind of in a sutra form because it's going to be expanded later in the chapter. All right, so let's just go through this. So he was absorbed. When do we become absorbed? You think of the word absorbed in a scientific sense. You have a cloth and you put it on something that's wet until it absorbs all of the water. There's no water left. It's absorbed all of the water. To be completely, to be full of. So when do we become absorbed? Under what circumstances do we become absorbed?
When we're dry.
When we're dry. Well, when we're dry, that's good. When we're dry, we have the capacity to absorb. I like that, actually. And that's, in fact, quite related to this very painful for him. So if I'm already full of other stuff, then I can't become absorbed, right? Which is one reason why we say no illicit sex, no intoxication, no meat eating, no gambling. Because if one is full of such things, one will not be able to be absorbed in the Lord. You'll be blocked. Okay. When else do we become absorbed? So we become absorbed when we're open, when we're ready, when we have some receptivity, when we're not filled with something. It's very concentrated, yes. It's interesting, though, in Nectar of Instruction, text 8, there's a progression of concentration of absorption. It's not, many times devotees think it's an off-on switch, but it's not really. It's progressive, and it's degrees. So it's not either that your absorption is concentrated or your absorption is not concentrated. And if you've ever, who's here ever made real burfi? I mean, the real deal, not like powdered milk burfi. So when you make real burfi, you cook down milk, and at first it's your absorption is not concentrated. You put the milk on the stove, you light the fire, and you can do something else. And you check on it periodically. And then when you see it starts bubbling, you have to give it your attention so it doesn't overboil. And then once it's boiled and it's boiling, again, you give it your attention periodically. You can also be making dal and rice and sabji and so many other things. And at a certain point, it gets so thick that if you don't give it your full attention, it will burn. And then you start giving it your full attention, and and become fully absorbed, and then the milk itself becomes more and more and more and more and more and more concentrated. So our absorption in Krishna consciousness tends to be very much like that. It tends to gradually progress in concentration. But under what other circumstances do we become absorbed? Yes. What do you mean by identify with it?
Identify, I guess it's like I'm absorbing something, I can see its relevance to me.
Ooh, okay. Okay. So I become absorbed in something when it has some meaning or relevance to me. And that's a very interesting point, because before we can get a prayojana, before we have a goal, we have to have a sambandha. It has to have something to do with me. And we very rarely get absorbed in something, at least not for very long, if I don't think it has anything to do with me. The way that the newscasters try to get people absorbed in the news is they try to link it to something in people's immediate lives. If it's just news about somebody in another part of the world doing something else, we're not particularly interested. There has to be some connection with myself, otherwise our interest will wane very quickly. Yes.
I think absorption is also a function of what you've done before. So, you know, for instance, if you're, you know, many of the advanced devotees talk about performing sadhana and the pramamurta, which the practical experience is a much different level of absorption, and service becomes much later. If you've been studying Prabhupada's books or chanting,
what happens during the day, you mean?
What happens during many prior days? So, say you have services that comes up as you do, and you suddenly find yourself very absorbed, you can actually connect that back to what you've been doing in your sadhana for the previous week or weeks or months or even years.
Okay, I'm trying to understand what you're saying. So you're saying our absorption in our sadhana in the morning is very dependent on what we've done before that day?
No, I was talking about maybe just any service that you have, say in the middle of the day, you know, whatever. If you teach at the school, teaching the kids, and suddenly you become very absorbed in being Krishna's instrument in some way, learning or distributing books or whatever. Mm-hmm. And in fact, every recently made this point before the explain this better than I can. That distributing books is dependent on japa. You know,
So I think what you're saying is it's very cumulative. That to be absorbed in something is the result of something that's cumulative. That's very nice. In fact, that's referred to with the Calvary Boys, that they had accumulated heaps of pious activities. And Srila Prabhupada talks about this quite a bit. Prabhupada talks about this in terms of starting active Krishna consciousness. He says you have to accumulate a certain amount of Agyata Sukriti first, before you can start Krishna consciousness. In other words, you have to do a lot of Krishna unconscious things. That's what agyata means. You're not aware of it. It's sukriti, it's pious activities, but you're not really aware of what you're doing. So you have to start getting some connection with Krishna on that level before you can have some Krishna consciousness. It has to build up to a certain point. And it seems like that also, our ability to be absorbed in something depends on what we're doing all the time. That you can't just say, okay, now I'm just going to start being absorbed in something. I find that to be the case with a project that I'm working on. It's very hard to just switch. The absorption generally has to build up over some time. It has to be something you're meditating. Some articles for Back to Godhead that I wrote really took 10 or 15 years to write. In the sense that I was planning for them, thinking about them, and being and gradually building up that absorption to you could write something. Yes? Yeah, a need.
You know, like if you're really, really hungry,
You become absorbed in the prasada. The greater the hunger, the greater the absorption in the food, and the greater the taste of the food. And this is true with everything. You know, if you want to learn a foreign language and you have no need to speak that language, you won't absorb yourself in the study of it, and consequently you won't learn much of it. You know, we were talking yesterday about at the school about the benefits of being a teacher in a Hare Krishna school, and I said one of the benefits is you learn a lot of slokas, because you have to teach them to the children. So there's a need to learn them. Whereas I know devotees who have to learn slokas, say, to pass the Bhakti Shastri exam, and they really struggle with it because they're learning it just for the exam. It's not something that they're needing. So when we feel a need for Krishna, you know, I really need Krishna. If Krishna is sort of like, yeah, it will be nice. Yeah, okay. You know, when the hunger is not very strong. This is why Rupa Goswami says the price is greediness. And if you can find it, beg, borrow, or steal it without delay, if it's available anywhere. Because this hankering, and we'll see in Narada's story, as far as you're saying about the dryness and the painfulness, so this feeling of emptiness, and this of course brings us to the next thing of separation. That one reason Narada could be absorbed is that he felt separated from Krishna. You know, most conditioned souls in the world don't have this acute intellectual and emotional and even physical feelings of being separated from the Lord. They're just not feeling it. Something like a very little child, our oldest child when he was very little, he would regularly wander off and not pay any attention to where his mommy and daddy were. You know, we'd go to some big park and he would just be walking away. And we'd be watching him and thinking, is he going to look back and check on us? But he never would. You know, you just walk and walk and walk away without any awareness that I'm getting further and further and further away from my mommy and daddy. I mean, I'm sure at some point he would become aware that, well, I'm lost, what am I going to do? Right? I mean, it happened to me when I was 6 that I went to the park with my mother and I said, you know, can I go to the playground? And I went to the playground and then I looked around and I didn't see her and then I became afraid. But for a long time, I'm just playing without some conscious awareness that there was a separation. So most conditioned souls don't have a conscious awareness or some sort of emotional awareness that, wait a minute, I have this, I don't feel the presence of God. You know, where is he? God isn't here. And the devotees, this is the main way that we're told that we should worship the Lord, with some intense feeling of separation, which is impossible to get if you think, oh, I'm nicely situated in the world. That doesn't mean it's impossible to get if you have a nice house and money in the bank and a car in the carport. It doesn't mean that all devotees have to live out on the street with only a blanket in order to feel the separation. But this is part of the mood of absorption, of feeling that I have a need. If I think, you know, this is one of the problems, indeed, we were talking the other day about people in sattva guna. That sometimes the people in sattva guna are the people who feel the least need, because they think, you know, I'm already happy, I'm already above sinful activity, I'm already internally peaceful, even though the happiness in sattva guna is so insignificant compared to spiritual happiness. It's very limited. All right, and then we have transcendental thought, absorb in transcendental thought and separation. So what does this mean, transcendental thought? So this is filling one's mind with thoughts of the Lord. The Lord's name, the Lord's form, the Lord's qualities, and the Lord's pastimes. And this, of course, this transcendental thought is the essence of what bhakti yoga is. What is the practice of bhakti yoga? If we were to define it in one sentence, we would say the practice of bhakti yoga is to... Always remember Krishna, never forget him, absorb your mind in Krishna. That is, if we were put in a nutshell, what is bhakti yoga? That is what bhakti yoga is. Always remember Krishna, never forget him. Or man mana bhava bhakta, or maya shakta mana bhakta. That's our succinct sutra for what is bhakti. So this is the practice that Narada was doing. I mean, externally, he was doing a meditative practice that's going to be a little different from what we're doing now at the Kali Yuga. So the externals are going to be a little different. But the essence of Bhakti Yoga is the same, transcendental thought of separation. Now what about this very painful for him? So does this mean that we have to experience pain in order to have the Lord show up? And I think that a lot of times we assume that that's the case. In fact, Srila Prabhupada said any spiritual process that doesn't involve austerity is cheating. You know, I like to talk about how Krishna says that tapasya is his heart and soul and is his very self, and you can always find the Lord in yajna. But this separation and this feeling of aching for Krishna, although it's very painful, it's also very sweet. Like I believe it was Radharani who said that we don't know how to do it. And I'm thinking that it's in Vidagdha Madhava. That this love for Krishna, it's just like having nectar poured on your head and at the same time drinking a whole vat of poison at the same time. We're not quite sure what it is. Is it poison or is it nectar? And it's interesting. I remember when I first read that, it reminded me of the poetry class I taught at Gurukul to the secondary school students. And we studied one poem about what is love. And of course, the person was writing about material love. And he was saying, you know, if this is a bad thing, why is it filling you with such happiness? And if it's a good thing, why is it filling you with such pain? This simultaneous extreme love and pain. By the way, on that note, I just found out that some of the poetry that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was reciting during the Rath Yatra and at Jagannath Puri was written by mundane persons to describe mundane love. Did you know that? Just ask Bhanuswami, because when he's reciting this poem, where was I reading it? Can't remember if it was in Chaitanya Charitamrita or teachings of Lord Chaitanya, perhaps someplace else. And it was mentioned that Lord Chaitanya sang this song. It says, although it was spoken by another woman. So I asked Bhanuswami, who's this other woman that is spoken by? And he said, oh, this was originally a mundane poem written by some ordinary person for an ordinary person. So that was interesting, just a little note that was interesting. But so this pain that Narada is experiencing, it's not like material pain. It's not like material pain. It's because it's mixed with relationship, it's very sweet. You know, again, we have some idea materially. You know, the soldier who's away in the battlefield, and while he's away at the battlefield, his pregnant wife gives birth, and the woman's standing there with the baby who's never seen her father, and the soldier comes off the plane or the boat or whatever, and, you know, you can imagine the feeling of the man and the feeling of the woman before he appears, huh? She's watching the other soldiers get off the plane, and she's watching the other soldiers get off. And it would be intense pain, yes? It would be very intense pain. And he's standing in the queue, in the line, you know, in the plane or in the boat. And my wife and my baby I haven't seen. And I see photographs. But wouldn't it also be sweet? It wouldn't be just pain. You know, pain is when you love somebody for 10 years and find out they've had 10 secret affairs and they've just been cheating you and, you know, they've been siphoning all your money into gambling or something like that. You know, that's just pain. There's nothing sweet about that at all. That kind of separation. You thought this was someone you could trust, and after 10 years you find out that they were just a royal cheater. And you go through divorce court, you know. And you have to bring up all these things. You know, he was gambling away all my money, and he had 10 women on the side. And he never loved me for a moment. He was only using me from day one. That's pain. That's a pain of separation. So it's not very painful in that way. But this is more painful separation that's mixed with love. It's mixed with relationship. And then, of course, it's not mentioned here, but We understand as the chapter progresses that Narada Muni was not able to do this process without Guru. So even though it's not specifically mentioned in this verse of purport, I think it's important to mention that you can't just make up a process of absorption in transcendental thought in a great pain of separation yourself. You can't concoct your own process. That just like we have to understand this process by studying Narada, so Narada also had to be trained by his guru. Then we could also look a little bit about what the Lord's doing here. And the Lord, of course, is independent. He just shows up for a minute. So imagine again this scene with the soldier and his wife and baby. And if the soldier comes and sees his wife and says, "Oh, by the way, they're going to deploy me again in 5 minutes. There's the other plane that I'm going to get on." Whoa. I mean, talk about heart-wrenching. Sorry, I've just come here for 5 minutes. You're not going to see me again. I'm going back to Afghanistan. There's my unit. Bye. So just, you know, like that. The Lord is independent. And he's not. Of course, the devotee has a feeling of mamata. This feeling of mamata is essential in the higher stages of bhakti, that the Lord is mine. I am the Lord's and the Lord is mine. And the person who has the most feeling of this mamata, who has the most intense feeling of this mamata, that Krishna is mine. Radharani. But even with Radharani, does Krishna sometimes leave and do what he wants? In Rasalila, Krishna left even Radharani. And she was also lamenting in the forest that Krishna has left, Krishna has left. So Krishna is independent. Even those who have the highest feeling of possession of Krishna, he can come and go as he pleases. That the relationship between the Lord and the living entity is that the Lord is the master and the living entity is the servant. I cannot own Krishna like he's a pet. Like Prabhupada would say about the guru, don't think your guru is your pet. You know, I know I have some very nice guru, but if he ever gives me instructions, then our relationship will be terminated. Some instructions I don't like. If Krishna does something in my life I don't like, then I cut the relationship. So no, he's independent. And Krishna is coming because he's attracted. Krishna is not coming because he's obligated. You can't. This is not a mercantile exchange. It's not that if I chant. You know, if I chant my 16 rounds every day, or maybe if I chant 17, or maybe if I chant 25, or maybe if I chant, you know, 58 or something like that, Krishna will be obligated because I've paid him. There's that story of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, where there was one man talking in the class, and Bhaktisiddhanta Prabhupada says to this man, "Do you think by your 500 rupee donation every month you've purchased me? And now you can do whatever you love." So it's not really exactly that one purchases Krishna. Although sometimes Krishna says like that to his devotees, "You've purchased me with your love." Like Krishna says to Rukmini, you know, "By your fainting out of anxiety of separation, you purchased me for all time." But still the Lord is independent. And he's coming because he's attracted. He's not coming exactly because of the rituals that we perform. The rituals are really a framework for an exchange of love. In and of themselves, they're not meaningful. You know, you could have a wife who cooked in a certain way and set the table a certain way, and you could also hire a servant to do exactly the same thing. So it's not the externals of it. It's the, as one of my friends likes to say, the leelas are not about the plot. They're about the emotion that's being exchanged between the Lord and the devotee. So Krishna's attracted, and he's attracted because Narada is absorbed in transcendental thought, in great separation. And of course, Narada will get to a point where he doesn't see the Lord just for a moment, but Krishna is teasing like that. And this is very commonly done, even materially. You know, nowadays, even to sell books, they make a video trailer to sell the book. You've seen this, some of the devotees, they've made video trailers for their books, or some little preview for the movies, a little 2-minute preview for the book, for the movie, or a little sample they give you in the shop. You know, here's a little free sample. And you taste this, and then you want to get some more. And so Krishna's also doing that with his devotees. So our absorption should be not only in the janma karma of the Lord, but also the janma karma of the devotees. So that we can know what is the path, so that we have a vision of what we're aiming for. And ultimately, also so that we can pick up the mood of the devotees and develop deeply into this exchange of love with the Lord. So questions or comments? Yes.
You mentioned something before about loving goodness. Sometimes those people don't have that absorption because they're absorbing loving goodness, whereas the motive of lives can be essentially somewhat of a paradox. Because
isn't that interesting?
Because, you know, it seems that the loving goodness is a springboard for the
it is.
Spiritual life.
Yeah, it's a fact. Well, this is, you know, it's something like the Singapore airport is really nice. If you ever go to the Singapore airport, wow, is it nice. There's little gardens in the middle of the airport. Actual gardens with real flowers, orchids even, in an airport. You know, you think they must be plastic, and you feel them, and they're real flowers. And there's real water with real fish in it. And these little benches you can sit and just chant. The little garden in the airport. So you might miss your flight. In fact, it happened to my daughter-in-law. She was flying back from India. And she got so absorbed in talking to one of the other passengers, she missed her flight. So, you know, if things are really nice, you can think, this is the downside of the upper planets. So, from one perspective, it's a lot easier to be Krishna conscious on the higher planets. Because you're already almost Krishna conscious. It's a lot easier to be Krishna conscious in the other ages of the earth, because again, you're already almost Krishna conscious. You're already conscious of Krishna to a large extent. You're not so covered. The ability to focus your mind and absorb your thought in God is very strong. But on the other hand, you may not feel as strong of a need. Because the mode of goodness is the only mode that really gives you any kind of satisfaction. The mode of ignorance gives no satisfaction according to Krishna. I mean, there's a kind of satisfaction of I'm really evil. There's a certain satisfaction. Just suffering. Suffering now, suffering later. And the mode of passion, you know, there's a little bit of pleasure from pious sense gratification. In the mode of ignorance, it's all impious sense gratification. So there's a little bit in the mode of passion, but the mode of passion is mostly sacrifice with a little bit of enjoyment. You know, 50 weeks of working hard, 2 weeks of vacation. 5 days of working hard, 2 weeks on the weekend, and then on the weekend you have to mow the lawn and you have to fix the pipes. So, you know, it's mostly working hard for a little enjoyment. And in the mode of ignorance, it's all sacrifice. Even the enjoyment is sacrifice. In the mode of passion, the enjoyment is the enjoyment, but the sacrifice is sacrifice, and there's a lot of sacrifice. In the mode of goodness, everything becomes enjoyment. The sacrifice also starts becoming enjoyment, the process of sacrifice. becomes also enjoyment, Bhagavad Gita 4:24. And in the mode of goodness, you have this sense of inner peace and inner balance. I'm sure we've experienced it. This kind of I am peaceful. I am balanced. I am equipoised. I eat only healthy food. My body works nicely. The things in the world don't bother me. It's a nice place to be. Now, compared to spirituality, it's nothing. But compared to passionate ignorance, it's really something. And when one has that, you may not be as interested. Although, having that gives you greater facility. If you're already equipoised and you're already peaceful and you're already clean, if you do think of Krishna, it works a lot faster. But you may not feel as hungry. You may feel, I figured out how to enjoy the material world. All these other people striving so hard for materialistic things. But I'm happy within, and I'm balanced within, and I'm in harmony with nature. And I have some sense of God. I can feel God. As you can feel God a little bit inside of you. Does that make sense? And sometimes the person in ignorance, they can say, oh, I have nothing. There's not a shred of happiness in my life. I'm completely in turmoil. So, sometimes we say that the best situation to become Krishna conscious is a human body in Kali Yuga, which is a little odd, isn't it? A human body in Kali Yuga, it's generally diseased. How many people do you know that can say they're 100% healthy? And generally mentally disturbed, like always disturbed. Use anxieties about something. See if you can find somebody who has no anxiety about anything. It's very hard. No disease, no anxiety about anything. We don't live very long. There's not much time. It's what feels like as soon as you really start practicing Krishna consciousness in earnest, then death is looking you in the face. So many of my devotee friends have already died. And many of them younger than I am now. And I feel like I'm just starting my Krishna consciousness this morning. So, or maybe I haven't even started yet. So, your life is so short. So wouldn't it be better to be Krishna conscious if you have a place where you have, millions and millions of years in one life that you can really perfect it in? Your body doesn't have any disease and your mind doesn't have any anxiety. You're very, very little. And you can, from birth, you can sit and meditate. So in one sense, it's a lot easier to be Krishna conscious if you're on Mahaloka or Tapaloka. It is. Or even Swargaloka. It's much easier to be Krishna conscious. It's much easier to be Krishna conscious in Satya Yuga. But on another hand, it's easier to be Krishna conscious when you feel that you're more in need. So each has its benefits. Each has its benefits. And we see when we preach to people that sometimes it's the sattva-guna people that are the hardest to preach to. This is my direct experience. When I was in Sydney, they were saying they had done some research. It was in Sydney. When I was in Wellington, it was Krishna Loka, who told me they were doing some research and that only 3% of the people came to Krishna consciousness came through the yoga programs. The vast majority came through book distribution, just kind of random. You know, when you go for that crowd, they're very open to Christian consciousness, isn't it? They're very open. But they kind of feel they already have it. They don't perceive that what they have is very small. They don't perceive that what they have is just like a reflection of the real thing. Does that make sense? You know, sometimes when you're in a lousy airport, you're a lot more likely to make your flight because you want to get out of there. But when you're in a really nice airport, you may just, you may lie down and go to sleep. And you may just look at the pretty koi in the water and forget that your flight's taken. Anyway, in general, the devotees like to live a life in sattva, but we should be very careful about becoming attached to sattva. Sattva is a golden chain, but it's a chain. I mean, sattva is nice. It's nice. It's all warm and fuzzy. When you stay in sattva, you just go to the higher planets and become like a brahaspati or something. Yeah.
So in that box, same life, if someone enjoys Krishna consciousness out of suffering, then we've seen their whole motivation has been to bring it to the whole idea is to get relief from the suffering, not necessarily to have a relationship with Krishna. So sometimes, does it seem that people that join with that motivation, when they have that desire fulfilled, then they lose that interest?
Well, therefore, Krishna says, and before we talked, were you here yesterday? Ah, what a
tip-tap.
What a tip-tap. Yesterday we talked about the four good guys and the four bad guys. You can look at the purport and see. Prabhupada calls them the good men and the bad men, the four good men and the four bad men. And we talked about how the Bhagavatam and Krishna consciousness, as Prabhupada talked about in yesterday's purport, Sri Narada advised Vyasadeva to describe the glories of the Lord just to do good to all eight classes of men, both good and bad. So it's exactly what we talked about yesterday. The people who come out of distress, wanting something material, because they're already fully Brahman realized, and because they're inquisitive. And then Prabhupada talked about how the Bhagavatam does good for the bad men. The mode of passion fools, the mode of ignorance fools, the mode of goodness fools, and the atheists. So, best the way that we should look at it for ourselves, in my useless opinion, but the way that we should look at it for ourselves is, what do I have that helps me and focus on that, instead of what do I have that hinders me and worrying about that? Figure out what do I have? What kind of body do I have? What kind of mentality do I have? What kind of motives do I have? All right, how can I use that to help me in Krishna consciousness? Instead of thinking, what better situation could I have that I can't actually have? Because you've got to start from where you are. You can't start from where you wish you were. It just doesn't work. If I want to get from here to the loft and I out call for directions, I have to tell them where I am. Right? Like these little GPSs, how do they work? They know where you are, which is kind of freaky in one way. Like there's somebody that always knows where you are. There's a little freakiness to that. But they always know where you are. And those little, the gizmos, you make a right turn and immediately knows you made a right turn. And if you don't follow their instructions, if you turn right when they told you to go straight, they'll recalculate from where you are. You wouldn't get good directions if you told the GPS that you were someplace else, just because it was closer or it was better or something. So we all are where we are. Some people who join the Krishna consciousness movement are, born in a Sarasvat Brahmin family, and they learn Bhagavad Gita slokas in the womb, and, they have generations and generations and generations of South Indian Sarasvat Brahmanas. I mean, I was just reading some fascinating research that our environment makes temporary changes in our genetic code that get passed down through several generations. know, there's something real to having birth in a family like that, where it has some effect on you. And you're, you know, in some pious place where Krishna is the center of the town and everyone's absorbed in Krishna consciousness, and you have that. Or maybe, you know, your parents were criminals, and maybe your parents were mafiosos or something, you know. You grew up with guns in the house, and your mother was snorting cocaine. Whatever it is, it is. Otherwise, then you think, well, I have to take birth in a Sarasvati Brahmin family next life, right? And then you look at what you have, and you see, what advantage do I have? Because everyone has an advantage. Everyone has an advantage. And a disadvantage can also be an advantage. Just like Prabhupada says that the male body is altogether an advantage for spirituality. And I have my own understandings of why that is. But he also points out two advantages of a female body, female psychology. One advantage is that women are very soft-hearted. So materially, that's really a problem, women's soft-heartedness. What does soft-heartedness mean? It means you're emotional. Because your emotions are always changing, they're always in flux. You're very easily emotionally influenced. We call that materially sentimental. But Prabhupada says spiritually, that's a benefit, because in bhakti, your heart is supposed to melt, and your heart is supposed to go on waves of different emotions with Krishna. That's the whole description of bhakti, in the bhakti rasamrita sindhu. So if you have a woman's psychology, you're already doing that. Except you're doing it about some kitten or something. So you just, instead of doing it about the kitten, you know, or the fact that your husband came home 5 minutes late and forgot to bring the milk, instead of doing it about that kind of thing, you do it for Krishna. But if you're late, you're already doing it. So the very thing that's materially a disadvantage, the very thing that materially obstructs your material intelligence, is a benefit in bhakti. Or the fact that women tend to follow an authority. This is a real problem for women. You know, if some man comes along and says, you can make a lot of money as a waitress in my country. You know, why don't you come with me? I can give you a job in my country. You can earn $50 an hour. And the girl says, okay. And guys will do that too, but women are much more inclined to do that. And then, you know, the guy kidnaps you and makes you into a sex slave or something like that. So this tendency, that much stronger tendency for women to follow authority than for men to follow authority. Men have much more independence. But that tendency, if you have the right authority, then it becomes a benediction. Or if you think about children, you know, generally we think children, if you're in a child's body, that's not as good for spiritual life. Children are much, they don't have any focus. They have this wide angle lens, and they just take in everything. They don't control their senses very well. They don't control their mind, their emotions. They're not very clean by nature. Everything goes into their mouth, yes? They're very me-centered. So altogether, being an adult is much more favorable for spiritual life than being a child. But you know what? Children have a very simple faith. If you say, here's Krishna, and he's real, and he's a person, then that it just is for them. There's Krishna, and he's real, and he's my friend. And children can have this deep, deep, real faith in Krishna, that if you come to Krishna consciousness as an adult, it might take you 25 years of practice. So everything has its good side and its bad side. I read a study about some of the most amazing people in the world who accomplished amazing things, and many of them had some sort of horrible, horrible, horrible crisis in their life. You know, their mother died when they were two, or something awful. And for some people, when they have a crisis, they become damaged by it. They get like post-traumatic stress syndrome or something, and they're damaged. But other people who go through a crisis become stronger and think, oh, if I live through that, I can live through anything. And they get incredible courage. So it's more, if we want to finish in this life, then rather than saying, if I had a better circumstance, it would be easier for me to be Krishna conscious, which might be true. That might be a true statement. But rather than saying that, which just pulls us to another circumstance, because if that's what we're saying to Krishna, Krishna, if only I had another circumstance, then Krishna will arrange that other circumstance. And sometimes that other circumstance can't be arranged in this life. Instead, see, what do I have? What do I have? I've got something. I mean, I always felt it was a disadvantage being an American as far as becoming a devotee of Krishna. I always felt that was a heavy burden, a heavy disadvantage. And what to speak of being a woman? That really felt being an American woman was a bad deal as far as trying to be a devotee. And then I was listening to a class that Bhakti Chiruswami gave in London. And he was talking about the blind man and the lame man, and he was talking about combining the best of the East and the West, and how people are following the West. And it was just this revelation to me that, you know, people in the world really do, as much as Americans are criticized, and Americans are criticized all over the world. They're criticized and they're emulated also. So what the Americans do does become, which is what Prabhupada saw, which is why Prabhupada went to my hometown of New York. You know, and he saw that. And then I thought, in the modern day, women are also becoming leaders in the world, and how women are behaving is all that. Maybe that wasn't true 100 years ago, but it certainly is true now. And I thought, at this particular point in history, for me to have an American woman body is actually has some favorable aspects for Krishna consciousness. That people in the world will look at me and say, oh, I want to be like that. And all of a sudden it changed my whole perspective. I saw, oh, I have a preaching opportunity with this body that other people aren't going to have. Or how much I've appreciated being a native English speaker. That Srila Prabhupada's books are in English. Prabhupada's lectures are in English. You know, I was just in Indonesia, and the movement's been there since the 70s when Prabhupada was on the planet. They only have translated up to the 6th canto of the Bhagavatam in 2015. They cannot read it. And they all love Nisingadeva, and they don't have the Nisingadeva story translated in the Bhagavatam into their own language. They're real Nisingadeva. Every temple has a deity of Nisingadeva. They're really into Nisingadeva. Big pictures of Nisingadeva. One of the temples, they chant the whole Nisingakavacha twice a day in their separate Nisingadeva temple. And they don't have the seventh canto of the Bhagavatam in their own language. They don't have Majjhalila and Anchalila. They only have Adilila. So on the one hand, I could think, oh, if only I had been born in India in one of those villages where they speak Sanskrit. And I would have Sanskrit as my mother tongue. You know, Hindi, Bengali. Why do I have to have a native English speaker? But, you know, in Prabhupada's ISKCON, being a native English speaker is a great benediction. You understand what I'm saying? So it's always like that. It's always like that. Or I know one devotee who's mentally ill, who's a paranoid schizophrenic, and thinks, you know, there's monsters coming out of the walls. But because this devotee thinks there's monsters coming out of the walls, this devotee takes exclusive shelter in Krishna. I think I can trust so many people. I think so many people are my shelter. Now, overall, you can say it's easier to be Krishna conscious if you're mentally sane, correct? But even somebody who has a mental illness, they can see, oh, this, I can, it may be a benefit. I may be able to use it that way. Does that make sense to you? So yes, ideally, if you want to become Krishna conscious, be in Goloka Vrindavan, that's your best place. If you have to be in the material world, be on Lord Brahma's planet. And each planet is progressively worse and worse and worse and worse. But, maybe the fact that we're only going to live for 60 or 70 years gives us some impetus. Hmm? Maybe that. Find the benefit. Find what you have that helps you and focus on that. Don't focus on the things you can't change that are impediment. What's the point? Is that okay? And as far as preaching to others, find what they have that'll benefit them. Find the thing in their life that'll help them. Anybody else? Yes.
Just like what you said about having a goal, and is that when I came to Krishna consciousness, I came through a yoga route, studying yoga, and the difference essentially was that I had a certain goal that made me want to take a Krishna consciousness. And my goal of yoga was because I wanted to know God.
You wanted to find God.
So when Krishna consciousness was presented to me, I was like, great, here we go. Whereas I tried to show the rest of my group that I was studying with Krishna consciousness, they're like, oh, no.
Because that wasn't their goal.
Their goal is not finding God. They want to enjoy. They want to learn to yoga because there's something for them. They want the benefits.
I really like that, and I think that also answers the other question, that even somebody in the mode of ignorance may be looking for God. Like when Prabhupada first started preaching, we like to say he was preaching to the hippies, but you know, the hippies never called themselves hippies. Other people called them hippies, but they didn't call themselves hippies. They called themselves freaks. So, but they were looking for, many of them were looking for spirituality. You know, a lot of the behavior of the original hippies was an imitation of some people in India that smoked marijuana and had long hair and beads and flowers. And yeah. A lot of the beginning of that movement was a search for spirituality. Even though they were doing it through the mode of ignorance.
And like the, when you're saying like, well, if only I had these circumstances, those circumstances, are like how you're saying that, you know, all these circumstances might be good for Krishna consciousness, but there'll be simultaneously that it'll be also even better for material enjoyment. So then if the goal is, where the goal is at.
Exactly.
It's going to
you can use anything material you can use for Krishna, you can use for Maya.
Good karma and bad karma, he said stool. You like
wet stool and dry stool.
Stool.
It's all stool. She'll drop my candy.